and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. The worst things that we subject others to do in this world are often things that we don't even see. People working in slaughterhouses, jails, or prisons, doing military operations. So many of these jobs are grotesque and difficult, and something we generally would not want to do. And often these tasks are conducted behind closed barriers. One reason for that is we just don't want to see the tragic things happening around us. We can't stomach it, and we want to go on with our lives pretending that maybe it's not really happening. There are a lot of examples of this in modern American life. For the most part, we don't see Amazon workers toiling in factories, accruing injuries so we can get our products in 24 hours or less. We don't see Southern Border Patrol agents who are ordered to stop people from coming into this country, sometimes subjecting these migrants to dying in a desert that has no food or water. And there's a question about the dynamic here, the interaction. Why do we place people in these jobs in the first place? Why do we force people to enact such harm onto others as a way of earning a paycheck? Why do we tolerate this kind of work? IL Press directly and indirectly asked these questions in his new book, Dirty Work: Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. But his book goes even further. Dirty Work interrogates the moral structure of our societies. It asks whether people are unethical or if their jobs simply give them no choice in making unethical decisions. It wonders why people should have to do work that's often considered immoral at all. And the book pushes all of us to consider if we can create a more equal and fair society that doesn't force others to carry out unethical or really awful tasks that subject animals or humans to an uncomfortable degree of suffering. In addition to writing this book, IL Press is a writer and a journalist who contributes to a number of publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Times. We've got him with us today to talk about what dirty work is and whether it's possible to build a world where it doesn't exist. IL Press, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Yeah. So let's start with this term, dirty work, as you describe it. Who does this work? And what is this work in your view? What makes up dirty work?
Yeah, so the definition I give in the book is a little different than the one that I think most people think of when they hear just the phrase dirty work, because, you know, it's a colloquial expression that is associated with, I think, jobs or tasks that are kind of physically dirtying, like hauling the garbage off the streets. But in my book, dirty work refers to something different. It refers to morally troubling activities that are carried out with the tacit consent of, you know, a large part of society, but that are often hidden from view, as you stated in your introduction. So things like working on the lines of industrial slaughterhouses, which supply, you know, the meat and poultry that feeds the country, or working inside the wards, the mental health wards of America's jails and prisons. And jails and prisons in America have actually become our largest mental health institutions. And in these jobs, as well as in the other jobs that I look at in the book, there are inevitable moral dilemmas that come up for the folks who are tasked with doing this work. And this gets to the second question you asked. So who are those people? And in a nutshell, you know, you'd have to read the book to get a more detailed sense, but the basic point of the book is that these are not jobs that are distributed to society's elites. You know, you don't have graduates from Harvard and Princeton being asked to do these things. You don't have the sons and daughters of senators and lobbyists. The work that I look at in the book tends to be delegated to the least advantaged, to people in poorer parts of the country, where often you know, the good jobs have left, factories have closed, the mills have shut down, and what's left is you know, the local county jail, you know, a place where in the middle of a rural area where there aren't a lot of good jobs, and suddenly there's a big industrial slaughterhouse there that starts recruiting not only some of the local folks who work around, but a lot of undocumented people and immigrants to work. And so what I argue in the book or try to show is that this is indeed a form of inequality, but it's very hidden. It's not something we notice. I think most people, especially after the pandemic, are aware that, you know, people who work more menial, less lucrative types of jobs, you know, grocery clerks and bus drivers and you know, warehouse handlers, that they shoulder the bulk of the physical risks that come with work, right? We saw that during the pandemic when these folks were out there doing work and getting sick while other people were sitting at their computers, you know, getting packages delivered to them and food delivered to them. And that kind of, I think, is a general awareness that you're more likely to get hurt, to be exposed to, you know, a virus, to be exposed to injury if you do, you know, more blue-collar work, more marginal types of labor. But I think the same point applies to the moral divide in our labor force. That is that jobs that are stigmatized, jobs that put people in very difficult moral situations that require them to numb themselves in some way, that these jobs too tend to be delegated to the least advantaged. And so in that sense, we have not just, you know, economic inequality, but also moral inequality.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we start the book inside the walls, of prison, really. Let's talk about that work and why you highlight it up front in the book.
Yeah, so I wanted to take readers on journeys into hidden spaces, places that we all know exist in our society, but that a large number of people never go near, never see the insides of. And that is a common feature of what I call dirty work, that it takes place behind closed doors. And prisons are a really vivid example of that, jails and prisons. And in the particular prison I focus on at the start of the book, this is a prison called the Dade Correctional Institution. And it's located about an hour south of Miami, but it is literally a world away from, you know, the Miami that most people think of when they go for vacation or they think of beaches. Mm-hmm. And at this particular prison, I follow initially the story of a woman named Harriet Kraskowski, who worked in the mental health ward and who ends up getting enmeshed in really wrenching moral dilemmas while she's working there.
And talk about those moral dilemmas and the way in which it takes not just kind of a physical toll, the work, but it takes this emotional and mental toll as well.
Yeah, so Harriet is a really good example of that. And she, when she started this work, it was post-recession. after the 2008 Great Recession, there were not a lot of jobs. And she ends up getting a job at Dade. She had never worked in a prison before. It was an all-male institution. She's a young woman working in the mental health ward. She wants to go into that kind of work, but she's a little scared. And she also, goes into it thinking, well, at least the guards will have my back if anything happens. When she goes into the prison and starts working there, she starts hearing the prisoners in the mental health ward tell her that they're being mistreated. Some of them start telling her that they're not getting their meals. They're getting empty meal trays. She starts witnessing some really rough mistreatment. She is in charge of taking a group of guys into the rec yard, which is this sort of open area. It's outside, but of course it's enclosed and fenced. But it is the only time that that these guys get to be outside and kind of get some fresh air and so sunlight. And she's supposed to do this on Sundays, and she keeps being told for different reasons she can't take them out. It's one excuse after another. And so eventually she complains about this in an email to her boss. And the boss, is not happy about this because the guards are not happy about this. Mm-hmm. And what Harriet soon discovers after that is that because she has spoken out about what she feels is being done, she's in a group session with a bunch of the prisoners, and suddenly the guard disappears, who's supposed to be at the door, for her protection, disappears, leaving her alone. She goes into the rec yard one day, and again, she's left on her own. And she sent a message that all of the mental health workers at this prison were sent, and in fact that mental health workers in all jails and prisons are sent, which is basically, we run this place, we being the security personnel, the guards, and don't, step out of line. If you have a problem, keep it to yourself. And the problem here is that Harriet is then in the position of realizing that there's a lot of abuse and mistreatment going on, and she wants to say something about it, but she doesn't say anything about it because she's been sent this message. Mm. And it proceeds. That's the sort of first part of the story, and she's troubled by all this. She eventually learns that the abuse at this particular prison reached a really extreme point, and that some of the mentally ill prisoners at Dade were being locked inside a shower with scalding water directed at them, and were not allowed out of this shower. And she learns this when a prisoner named Darren Rainey dies inside this shower. And Harriet is horrified by this and again wants to report it, but doesn't report it. And in fact, none of the staff reported it. We only know it happened because another prisoner ended up leaking the story to the Miami Herald. But all of this transpires within this sort of enclosed institution where, as I suggest, dirty work of this kind can unfold, and usually unfolds without us ever learning about it.
Yeah. And there is something about the humanity of both the worker here and the people that they are, charged with taking care of, I guess, in kind of a crude sense, that bonds them together, I think, in a way, and separates them, really, from the rest of us. I mean, what they have in common is that they're having this experience on both sides of it. It's anguishing for them. And in a way that there isn't, as you point out in the book, there isn't a connection to the rest of us. It is hidden. It is separate by design.
That's right. And I think that I want to stress the humanity part of it, because I really feel like the reason that Harriet and some of the other coworkers I interviewed who were working at Date were so troubled by this is that they do have, you know, an ethical compass that was violated as they were seeing this. And by the way, Harriet did not expect that. She went into this job, as I said, really afraid. She thought the good guys were the guards and the bad guys were the prisoners. Mm-hmm. It was black and white for her. She said that to me. I had a very black and white view of this. You know, there were good guys, there were bad guys. She starts to do this work and realize it's more complicated than that. And she discovers her own sympathy, to her surprise, with some of the folks she is tasked with just, you know, trying to help and care for. And as I said, you know, a lot of the, you know, we don't have enough mental health care and institutions and community-based institutions in this country, whether it's Detroit or Miami. And so prisons and jails end up taking on that role. And I really think as institutions, they are forced to do the dirty work of a society that has decided this isn't important enough to us. You know, we'd rather not spend the money to provide better services, more humane conditions. And I should say that in the book, you know, I go on to interview some of the prison guards who both you know, worked in Florida and in other states. And, you know, one of the first things they say is, you know, we weren't given any training to do this. And indeed, I speak with a guy named Bill Curtis, who was a guard, and he kept a journal while he was working in Florida's prisons. And that's one of the points he initially, you know, sort of harped on. He's like, wow, there are so many, you know, people here who need mental health services. We weren't trained to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trained to just keep them locked up. And so it's the guards, too, that are placed in these, you know, really morally compromised positions and have to adjust to it. And I think that, you know, the larger question I'd like to readers to ask is not, you know, what's wrong with the workers who do this, but what is it about our society that we've decided it's okay to just kind of, you know, keep this work very hidden and away from us because we just don't want to, you know, maybe have to come up with a more expensive solution or a solution that, you know, would involve a different set of policies, a different set of priorities.
Yeah. And we don't want to see. I mean, there is a fundamental looking away, I guess, from these places and what happens in them that is kind of essential to us being okay with our lives and going on with them.
Absolutely. And I should say one of the, you know, to get back to Harriet and some of the other folks I wrote about, one of the things that I think they experience is moral injury. And this is a term that some folks may have heard in the context of military veterans, because in the past decade or so, along with PTSD, there's been a growing conversation within the military about soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and witnessed things or even participated in things that within the context of war are acceptable, but that go against their own basic ethical values. Mm-hmm. And when you're placed in that situation, which is so common in war, there's an aftermath. And, you know, how do you make sense of what just happened? And moral injury is a term for the kind of, you know, transgressions that people often witnessed or took part in and have to live with afterwards. And my book is really taking that idea and some of the other kind of emotional wounds of this kind of work and looking at how it reverberates in other parts of our society, whether it's prisons, whether it's slaughterhouses, in other places. And we can't put a dollar value on that kind of injury, but it can be, you know, really, really debilitating to a person. It can affect them no less than, you know, not having enough money at the end of the month to pay your rent. So that is how the sort of inequality piece, I think, ties into all of this.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with author I.L. Press about his book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. I want to get going with you on the phones and on social media as well. Why do we have dirty or immoral tasks as part of work? Is it a necessity for humans to function and flourish? Do some have to toil while others kind of bask in the easiness of technology and convenience? What would a world without this kind of work look like? Also, give us a call and let us know. Are you working in some place like this, a prison or a slaughterhouse or some other kind of invisible work that most people would think of as quote unquote undesirable? What are the things you deal with on a daily basis? How do you continue to do that job? And do you wish that life could be different, that society were organized in a way that didn't require that? 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Right today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We're talking with I.L. Press this hour. He's the author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. We're talking about hidden jobs, jobs in prisons, jobs in mental institutions, jobs working the border, the things that we don't really get to see or maybe don't want to see people doing in our society, and how that work ties in with the rest of our lives. Does it make our lives easier to have people doing these things and doing them out of sight? Is that right? Is there another way we could think of work and those tasks that would spare the people who are doing it, not just the physical toll of the work, but also the mental and emotional toll of that work? As always, we want you to be part of the conversation. Give us a call and tell us what you think about these kinds of tasks and whether you're somebody who does work like this. What is that like on a day-to-day basis? How do you continue to do work if you have a job that you think asks you to do something that's not moral, that's not right? Also, give us a sense of how you might reorganize things so that people did not have to do that. As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. Before we get to our listeners, IL, I want to talk about shadow people, which is another part of your book. And it describes a different kind of hidden work, a different kind of, I guess, looking away from the kinds of things people are asked to do.
Yeah, the shadow people in my book are undocumented immigrants who are working in a poultry slaughterhouse in Texas that I spent some time in and interviewed those workers. And, the striking thing, when we talked about prisons, I mentioned that this is, a prison is a state or sometimes a federal institution. So in that sense, there is a sort of collective, these things operate in our name, whether we like to think of it that way or not. The criminal justice system is something that, laws that the elected officials we put in office create and design, and that's how mass incarceration came about, and that's how, over time, jails and prisons became our leading mental health institutions. In the case of the shadow people, we're talking about something very different. These, industrial slaughterhouses, poultry beef, pork. These are private institutions owned by large corporations. Mm-hmm. So in a certain sense, a person listening might say, well, what does that have to do with me? But of course, it has a lot to do with a lot of us because of Kentucky Fried Chicken mm-hmm. and McDonald's.
Consumption.
What we choose to eat and how the things we eat are produced, and the shadow people I look at are part of this kind of invisible workforce that really processes most of the meat and chicken and poultry and so forth, and that goes into the American diet and into our consumption habits. I look at the conditions they work under, and there certainly has been a lot of attention paid to how animals are treated in the industrial food system, the work of Michael Pollan, the work of Jonathan Safran Foer and other writers mm-hmm. who have drawn attention to this, leading some people, many people to question whether they want to eat meat at all. But there's been far less attention paid to the folks who do the work. And that's really the focus of that section of the book. I felt like I wanted to look at, what do they go through? And what is it like to stand on the lines and do this kind of work day after day? And one of the main things that I learned is that because of the demand and the low cost of meat and chicken in this society, the lines are run really fast, and they're run faster and faster. And that leads not just to physical injuries, but also to potential emotional, abuse, because in this particular poultry plant, there was a problem with bathroom breaks. If the mostly female workers at this plant wanted to take a break, they were yelled at. And, because things were moving so fast, you either did that during your half hour for lunch or you didn't do it at all.
Yeah.
And so I look at this whole dynamic and raise questions about, how our food system is organized and who pays the price for that.
Yeah. There's also something about the undocumented status of these workers that I think is really critical to this part of the book and to this discussion. It's easier in this country to overlook people when we can assign a label to them that says their lives don't matter as much as the rest of ours. And that word undocumented has become one of those labels. I mean, there is this entire way of thinking about people who come to this country without going through the legal channels that has allowed us to say, well, it's kind of okay that they're doing this or that they're being treated this way because they have some culpability in the equation.
Right. And I think that, and what I try to show in this section of the book is that, this workforce, this didn't come about by accident. This was by design. In other words, some folks remember The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, mm-hmm. famous muckraking book about turn of the century slaughterhouses, in big industrial cities, Chicago and the meat plants that existed back then. Most of the workforce then was immigrant labor.
Yes.
The same kind of thing. Over the course of the 20th century, that changed and unions formed and, wages improved. It was still very difficult work. It was, I think some people would see it as inherently dirty because it involves, killing animals and processing, that. But the conditions did improve. And then in the 70s and 80s, it reverted back. And this was an industrial strategy. This was, there was one particular company that decided, we can run things cheaper by hiring ununionized workers. And lo and behold, they started, the different companies started recruiting, immigrants and refugees and so forth. And so it's this kind of double game where, you know, if there's a federal inspection or a raid, everybody, you know, pretends that you know, this is, that everybody should be documented and the companies don't know about it. But in reality, if you talk to the workers, it's pretty well understood that, you know, the undocumented workers are there for a reason, because they're more easy to control. They're less likely to form unions. They're less likely to speak out and assert their rights if they're mistreated, because, of course, they're worried not just about, you know, potentially getting fired, but potentially being deported.
Yeah, yeah. Michael on Twitter says, I worked in highly dangerous jobs while I was younger, since I was lucky and went to university and I got a, quote, safe job. One alarming thing was the pay at the dangerous jobs was so low compared to even the easiest roles at offices. Is this systemic? Why don't they pay more? Pay is one of the things that drives people to this kind of work, IL, is that they need the money. But of course, the money is often not even enough to sustain their lives. Talk about the role of money and pay in this dirty work.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said of Harriet Kraskowski in the beginning, when I was talking about why she got this job at a prison, she needs a job. She had two kids at the time, and her husband did not have a job. They needed to get by somehow. That's true of a lot of the workers I write about in this book. You know, that these are sort of jobs of last resort that they you know, ended up taking because there wasn't a better alternative. And it's absolutely the case that you know, despite the both physical and emotional risks that these workers take on the burdens and the risks, the pay is low. And it really does speak to what you know, Michael has said of his own experience, which is this sense that, you know, why is that? Well, you're putting your life on the line, and it should make us question. And by the way, there is a section of my book about you know, the government's role in all this. We do have a Department of Labor, and we have OSHA, you know, the Occupational Safety Agency, that is supposed to you know, police or regulate, at least regulate the workforce, so that jobs that are dangerous, that put workers in physical danger, that the companies are held accountable for that. But one of the things I discovered, and it still bothers me, and it's shocking, is that companies, the amount, first of all, OSHA's unable to regulate effectively, mm-hmm. because its budget is so small. Secondly, when they do find a violation, the penalty to a company for even a worker death is, you know, pocket change to these companies. They are often forced to pay far more for violating an environmental regulation. And that tells you something about what value we place on the lives of those workers.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with IL Press about his book, Dirty Work. We'll also continue to hear from you, the listeners, on the phones and on social. Give us a call. Tell us about jobs that you think of as dirty or undesirable. Why do we allow people to have to do those jobs? Are you somebody who is doing a job in a prison or sometimes some other place that is hidden from most of our eyes? What is that work like? Do you wish that there were other work available? Do you wish more people understood the emotional and mental anguish that you might be feeling in your job day to day? Give us a call. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
Bringing you news that matters.
Stories that impact your life.
Music from the Motor City and around the world. This
is 101.9 WDET,
Detroit's NPR station.
Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We've got I.L. Press with us this hour. He is an author of a new book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. We're talking about jobs that many of us would think of as undesirable, jobs that we don't see people doing so much as we just kind of know that they exist and that people have to do them. We're talking about the inequality that represents, because some of that work forces people to make decisions that aren't exactly moral. It makes people make choices about things that most of us wouldn't want to think of having to do ourselves. As always, on the phones, we want to hear about your sense of work, and especially after the pandemic, how work has changed, how our view of work has changed. Are there jobs that you maybe would do before that you wouldn't do now? Are there jobs that you think of people doing and maybe despair about what that does to them physically, mentally, maybe emotionally? What would we do differently to eliminate that kind of work, eliminate the need for people to be trapped in that kind of work? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll include you in the conversation that way. Ayel, I want to talk about the chapter Essential Workers, because as I just mentioned, the pandemic does really reframe the idea of work for us in this country. And there are a lot of people who are making choices about work that look really different now than they did before. But you also have folks who didn't have as much choice during the pandemic as the rest of us did. These essential workers, as we called them, I thought that was a kind of strange euphemism, given that much of the work they were doing was especially dangerous during the pandemic. Talk about how essential workers fit into the context of the dirty work that you're talking about in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that term is a really interesting one, because as you say, you know, it was sort of, in fact, in the building I live in, there's a little sign saying, you know, honor our, you know, salute our essential workers during the pandemic. It's still up. It probably, you know, has been there since the beginning of the pandemic. And I think there was this sort of collective realization, just as the early part of the pandemic, that we all relied on, workers who we rarely saw to do all these tasks that run our society, you know, delivering the packages and, you know, making sure groceries are there and, driving the buses and so forth. But I don't think that recognition translates into better wages, better working conditions, more humane treatment for the workers. Certainly, if you look at, meatpacking, hundreds, thousands of workers in the early part of the pandemic were ordered to go to work in slaughterhouses where basic safety precautions had not been. And as a result, many got sick and some died. To go back to what you said about, undocumented, well, that, these are not workers who have much of a voice, have much social clout. And so, one side we were hearing these were essential workers and seeing them honored at ceremonies at the White House and elsewhere. And on the other side, we were seeing that, there was very little being done to actually protect them and make their lives better. So I think that the pandemic kind of brought this to a full, brought awareness to this, put a spotlight on it. I do think there's been a change. It's an ongoing change within the American workforce as people are reevaluating, is the job I do worth it? There were obviously many people who decided no, it mm-hmm. wasn't. And, you know, we had this phrase, the great, a lot of people resigning or not deciding not to go back to jobs that they'd had. But I will say that requires a certain level of economic security. And in a society where we still have a lot of working poor, we still have a lot of folks who are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck on very thin margins, worried if, you know, an accident or an injury could bankrupt them, your choices are constrained. Mm-hmm. And you're not able to just pick and choose the jobs that you feel, you know, lend dignity to your life. You do the things you have to do to get by. And that's, you know, pretty central dynamic in my book, and I think still a central dynamic in our society, even post-pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, there is that profound inequality in that term itself, the great resignation, the idea that that it's universal, the idea of people being able to quit work and say, I'm going to do something else. These essential workers, I think, don't quite fit into that description, do they?
That's right. That's right. And in the last section of my book, I actually do look at, and some listeners may be wondering, well, wait a minute, what about white collar jobs mm-hmm. that involve a sort of ethically troubling activity of some kind, you know, selling deceptive, stock packages that end up bankrupting people or, you know, corporate lobbyists and so forth. I look at the tech world and in Silicon Valley, and in the past few years, there's really been an enormous number of tech workers who have kind of come forward and said, wait a minute, what is this technology I'm designing doing? Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's a social media app or a company that, I look at Google, actually, and one particular worker at Google who goes into the job thinking, you know, this is all about making information freely available and search engines and so forth, and then discovers that there's been an arrangement with China for a search engine that doesn't work if you put in terms like democracy, and becomes very morally troubled by that. And I think the key difference with those white collar, you know, workers who are asking these questions is that they tend to be people who have, you know, a lot of highly desirable skills mm-hmm. and education and, you know, advanced degrees, and they can land on their feet if they go elsewhere. They've got choices. And I think when we talk about, you know, folks working in slaughterhouses, folks working in prisons, that's a different story. Yeah. There's a lot less choice for them.
And you spend some time in the book also, and I want to make sure we talk about this, talking about the role that all of us play in maintaining the economic infrastructure that requires these jobs. We talked a little about our consumption of meat and other products that drive slaughterhouses and these other kinds of places that are bad places to work. But it goes beyond that. I mentioned Amazon a while back, and you know, I have to say up front, I'm somebody who absolutely loves the idea of finding something that I want to buy on the internet, pressing a button and watching it roll up to the house, you know, in 24 hours or less. Right now, in places like Detroit, we're able to get things same day if you spend enough money. And I never stop really to think about how that plays into somebody doing a job that is unbearable, that there is a cost of producing goods at that pace and delivering them the way they do, that makes this part of the inequality you're pointing out.
Yeah, well, I think that, I mean, that, look, we're all, I think I wrote the book, and I'm pointing at myself as much as anyone else. We're all feeling those questions these days because we live in a world that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, if you told people you could do that, you know, press a button and get something delivered to your door the next day, you know, it would have seemed like an unimaginable luxury.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very convenient, and it is very appealing on a lot of levels. But what we don't stop to think about enough, I think, is what is the cost of that convenience? You know, when you go to a store, a local store run by a family or a neighbor or someone you recognize, you see the folks working there, you interact, you have some human conversation. We don't have those conversations with the deliverer, you know, the person who delivers that package, let alone with the person in the warehouse who was, you know, maybe being pushed at to the breaking point to get that to your door quickly. And so I really think there is a cost that we're not seeing, that, you know, people are living. There are people that are on the other end of that. And so, you know, part of the point of the book and really of, I hope, this conversation is to get us thinking more about, you know, is our convenience worth that? And shouldn't we have, in a society that is, you know, so advanced that can technologically pull that off, shouldn't we also have, you know, take the time to make sure that no one's being exploited when that happens, you know, that someone doesn't have to wind up on painkillers or in the hospital or with a debility, you know, just think about the lives of the folks doing this labor, and whether we really want a society that hides that.
Yeah. We've got just a few minutes left, but I would be remiss if I didn't put this in the context of labor in a historical sense. And of course, the labor that grew here in Detroit and Henry Ford's $5 day and the unionization that then grew inside the industry and made life better for so many people, built the middle class in this city, at least, and some people would say throughout America. It stands in such contrast, I feel, to some of the things that you're talking about in this book. And of course, at the time that the auto industry is changing work in this country, there is still dirty work that's being done as well. But I wonder what you make of that that juxtaposition of the things that we have accomplished in the 20th century in terms of making work safer, better, higher paying, making sure that people are taken care of after they're done, and the persistence of this dirty work at the same time.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Buffalo, so I'm a real you know, connection to the Rust Belt, mm-hmm, and to mm-hmm. the parts of the country that really suffered when a lot of plants shut down and moved south or then eventually moved overseas. And, you know, I don't know the story of Detroit the way I know the story of Buffalo, but in Buffalo, you know, when I grew up, there were a lot of folks who had worked those middle-class jobs who, you know, when they were gone, ended up, you know, taking jobs that paid less or more precarious or didn't have the benefits and didn't have the sense of security that it gave people. And I think that, you know, we really haven't replaced those jobs. Mm-hmm. And maybe we shouldn't replace them because we shouldn't romanticize, you know, what that work entailed. But I don't think we're going to a better place when, you know, you read about folks who are in these Amazon warehouses working in, you know, under equally, if not more arduous conditions, but without the union, without the job security, without the sense that you can support a family on this job and retire one day. So, you know, I think that we have not made progress in that sense, certainly not in parts of the country that have felt the pain of losing mm-hmm. those jobs. On the other hand, I think that unions are staging a comeback in different parts of the labor force, and that's a really, really interesting thing. You see it at Starbucks, at Chipotle,
sure.
You know, all these places where we don't associate with unions are suddenly forming unions.
Yeah. Okay, IL Press, it was really wonderful to have you here with us for this conversation. Congratulations on the book, and again, thanks for joining us on Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow. We're going to talk about a new report that reveals how Michigan kids are doing as a result of the intense pandemic. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.